rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Radio Mysterioso is here live again this week. And this week, as promised, if you read UFO Mystic, is my longtime friend Richard Saraday, who has been there almost from the beginning, from UFO Mystic days, sorry, Excluded Middle days onwards.
Yeah.
Is your microphone working? Here, I'll give you a little bit more bass, too. There you go.
Make me sound very heavy.
Yeah, like I said on UFO Mystic, did you read what I wrote up for you?
No. I never read my own press. I might start believing it. I'm inclined to want to.
I thought you would not read a review, because this wasn't a review.
Yeah, there's nothing to review right now, is there?
It was a review of your life.
oh, God, life review!
What I said was that Richard's one of those people that has a lot to say about the UFO subject. Intelligent stuff to say, and one of those people that's not invested with being a public figure. As you and I both know, Richard, a lot of those people in the UFO arena, people you never hear about, do some of the most interesting work and interesting things, and people you really want to talk to. You'll see them at a convention, or you'll keep up a correspondence with them, and you'll kind of go to them as, you know, what do you think of this? And this is what I do have been doing with Richard for...
I was wondering what that was.
Since, when did we meet, 92 or 3?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think it was 1982.
Yeah. When I first came out to your house in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And you showed me clips from General Hospital.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Richard was an actor on General Hospital for how many seasons?
I had a 3-year contract, 78 to 81. I left daytime after that because I had offers from other ABC soaps to go to New York and do another soap if I wanted, but, you know, I mean, you've done 3 years on the top show on television at the time, and it's soap opera. You go, okay.
Yeah, what else can I do?
I've done soap, and 3 years was definitely enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to see a real script. So, yeah, no, I had a rather, I supported myself all through the 80s with showbiz and early 90s, both in front of the camera, mainly as an actor, and then in the 90s, behind the camera, as I tried to bring all the different elements of film under my control. I worked for a friend as a first assistant cameraman, a friend of mine who graduated with me from college and was a DP and making a pretty good living in commercials. So.
Steve?
Yeah, Steve yeah. McMahon. Yeah. So he kind of tutored me, and I became his assistant for about 3 or 4 years, I think it was. 4 or 5 years, I'm not sure. And I'm paying the bills while I tried to develop projects around the UFO subject and submit them to Hollywood, which... Hollywood won, I lost, I give up. And, you know, I also decided that the more and longer I was in this field, the more I studied it, the projects I wanted to develop, I wanted strictly to be based on best guess of what's going on with as much information as possible. And every time you try to develop a series like that, like I was partnered with UFO Magazine, Don Ecker and I formed R&D Productions, and we tried to develop...
Rich and Don?
Yeah, Rich and Don. Rich
but that's good, R&D.
Research and development, yeah. You know. But the idea was not to just march out something that, you know, Hollywood might necessarily like and go, oh, yeah, okay, wait, who's the love interest? Oh, yes, I love the beautiful alien, you know.
Right.
But actually based on as much as we knew, you know. And
what a recipe for failure.
Yeah, exactly. It is a recipe for failure. I remember pitching the producers who eventually did... Independence Day, you know, a couple of years before they did Independence Day. I remember pitching them going in for like a 15-minute pitch and being there for 3 hours, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And then they say, okay.
You cleaned your brain.
Right. Well, we'll get right back to you, you know. We got, oh, let me see a copy of that. Yeah, you know. And they take everything and they say, we'll be back to you next week. And, of course, next week.
And you never hear from them again. And then they.
Well, it's just the Hollywood week just hasn't ended yet. It's only been 15 years. They will get back to me, I'm sure. So anyway, we partnered and tried to, you know, develop an idea for taking UFOs Tonight, which was Don's cable radio network show.
Right.
And try to take it to television. You know, we had a concept for, like, a half-hour version, then a successful hour version. And it was kind of a mixture of live in-studio interviews done on a set. You know, we had an idea for putting the Hollywood Planetarium, Griffith Park Planetarium,
Observatory, yeah.
You know, in the background, shown through windows, in front of which, you know, we're sitting at a news kind of thing, and then an armchair situation where we could interview.
Halfway between a news thing and a talk show.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Whatever those are called, backdrop, cyclorama, whatever you want to call it.
Right, and then we also had the idea, and Gary Kurtz came up with this idea. He was he was trying to march it for us, be our showrunner. He had been the producer on Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
And I met him when he crossed over to Disney, and I was filming with Steve at Disneyland, and he was in charge of the in-Disneyland productions, you know.
Oh, okay.
So we talked, you know, standing around the camera week after week, shooting the stuff, and before you know it, he asked me if he could be a showrunner, and so he was marching out our concepts. You know, actually, we came very close, very, very close. KCOP, Channel 13, and Channel 11 through Fox, we got both those stations were right up to the last minute, you know, competing and vying for the series concept.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and Sci-Fi had just opened, Sci-Fi cable channel had just opened, and we submitted a lot of things to them. And they were all interested, it was just the timing was wrong. You know, Sci-Fi was in its first year, they said, we have no budget. You know, it's all reruns right now, and if we make the grade, there'll be money down the road. So anyway.
Pizza
man.
Walter just got here. Our sometime co-host Walter just walked in with some pizza.
Hi, Walter.
You two met at the wedding, and
yeah, I do. I remember you from the wedding.
Yeah.
Right. So where? Oh yeah. So anyway, what I see now happening on all the cable channels with all these UFO shows being done by Bill Burns, who ended up buying Don Ecker out, you know, and taking over UFO Magazine, they're pretty much, you know, fulfilling the concept that Don and I had some years ago, a little bit differently than I would have, and I would host it a little bit differently, a little more. Less of a sell job on the interpretation of data that I see coming from Bill, you know, where it seems clear to me that he's really selling a point of view as opposed to exploring the possibilities, you know.
Well, it seems like either, one, he's selling the point of view or he's being told to do that. And I think it may be a little bit of both. Because I notice when you're working, and you probably notice this too, when you're working television or any kind of media where they're trying to, you know, get advertising and viewers and all that, that if you equivocate or not clear about things, no matter what it is, you got to be clear about something.
You have to be clear, and you have to take a strong position.
Yeah, and a strong position. Yeah,
right.
That's it.
So, I mean, I'm sure that's what it is. And, you know, he's got a good team assembled of people who are pro and con. So, I would imagine that since he's marching this stuff out, he's got to take a strong position, and it gives something for people to react to put it in perspective.
Right.
And being that he's producing his show, that's what he should do. You know? It's very interesting. There are endless topics. I think for good television, you know, part of our concept was to have a traveling team. I'll go back to Gary Kurtz. Remember the idea of like a, kind of like the Ghostbusters, more like a van all set up, you know, kind of like Taps does or whatever. But
the
we
mystery
had a,
machine.
Yeah, but a large RV with all kind of equipment, including the ability to broadcast from anywhere. And we'd go and do location spots that we'd you know, not just do for one episode. We might follow up a case or, you know, try to seek out. Like, I'd love to have gotten up to that ranch up in Utah.
If
Nids would let me even get near it, I doubt it. But that was our concept, you know. So it's nice to see it happening, you know. I feel like we were just ahead of the curve. Meanwhile, I've had to go on and raise a family. So I still watch the sidelines, and now it's been more of a personal interest to me, just a life quest to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have anything I'm trying to sell or anything I'm trying to buy. I just want to know. You know?
Right. How did you get interested in the government angle?
Well, I'm not.
You know about Walter, right? He's a former OSI.
No, I don't. I remember you telling me, but
Walter can come on when he's done with his pizza and talk.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm one of those child of the 50s. I mean, I was fascinated with UFOs all my life. You know, I was one of those kids who with my friend Richard, and it was Richard and Richard when I was like 11 or 12 years old, which would put us back in 1957, 58, you know, we were building rockets from scratch, you know, sending off the Edmund Scientific for chemicals and steel tubing and, you know, pre-machined nozzles and nose inserts and designing our own formulas and testing them down by the levee in New Orleans, shooting them into the Lake Pontchartrain, you know, and built our own static test stand behind our clubhouse, which we had designed to be shaped like a saucer, but ended up being just a box, you know, which may be cool because people describe boxes flying around now. But I always envisioned a saucer, you know, like we had a telescope up there. We were always checking the night sky. So, yeah, I was a child of the science fiction age. And if, you know, a new science fiction movie came out, you know, I was there at the Saturday matinee or the Friday night version of it, whether it be The Day the Earth Stood Still or Earth versus the Flying Saucers, one of my favorites, you know. So, yeah, I come by it rightly. You know, my uncles used to call me the spaceman, you know, so. But interestingly enough, and thing was, I can't recall if it was fifth or sixth grade, I got to meet Wernher von Braun, which was quite a thrill for me at the time, the rocket man, you know. Because my dad managed the trucking lines in New Orleans, and they were opening up the Michoud plant to build the Saturn booster. And they were having a big luncheon, I guess, for the local businessmen to say, hey, we're going to be doing a lot of business together, you know. My dad was invited. And it was the only time I ever saw my dad show up at my school, you know, at the door of my classroom. It was like, uh-oh, something's wrong. You know, it was about 11:30 in the morning, and suddenly my dad's standing at the door of my classroom asking, no, what's he doing talking to Sister Mary Assumpta, you know? And then I'm called to the front of the classroom, and I'm going, oh, somebody died. Who died? And he doesn't tell me anything. He says, come with me, son. And he puts me in the car and drives me down the road about 2 miles to Roosevelt Hotel. And there was Wernher von Braun talking to the you know, the businessmen about things. And my dad dragged me through the crowd afterwards up to meet him. And I remember shaking his hand. It was like my little bitty hand, this gigantic German hand, you know, this kind of fair-haired, big, larger-than-life character.
Yeah. You know, so that's what year was this?
I'm not sure it was 57 or 58. It was right around there because I was in grammar school. I can't remember if it was 5th or 6th grade, you know, in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. You know, and on the west bank of Mississippi is where they built the big plant that built the Saturn boosters. It's called Michoud, right. So that was really good for New Orleans for a long time. You know, not too far from Houston, you know, and not too far from Cape Canaveral. And
about halfway between.
Yeah, you know, something like that. So anyway, that was a thrill. So I come by my love of all things outer space, rightly, that combined with a lifelong fascination with, you know, the paranormal. And
any influence just because of being in New Orleans? Or you can find that kind of stuff anywhere.
No, nothing to do with being in New Orleans. You know, I was raised when I was growing up, New Orleans was like your typical all-American city, you know. I went to Catholic school, you know, wore little khaki uniforms. We went to church every Sunday, was an altar boy, you know. We dove under our desks for the nuclear alerts, you know. And
we did the same thing.
Tucked our head between our legs and kissed our ass goodbye, you know, kind of rehearsed that. You know, super patriotic. You know, anyway, I don't think my interest in the paranormal came from that. It really came from my own family and my experiences, you know, odd experiences, and my grandmother was kind of had that second gift too, you know. So, but it was something that would happen that you know, when you would precognize something, or you would have a, or you, I'm look how I'm distancing myself, you'd have an interesting experience. You just don't know what to think about it. You know, go, well, how did that happen? What you know?
I realized that today. I was doing an interview with the Paracast, and the host had a bunch of different weird experiences, and I never really have that much. A lot of people have a completely different reason for being interested in it, which is not my background. My background is just being interested in it for some reason when I was a kid and just holding on to that interest, and then it coming back later.
I was just going to throw in that it's my background is being weird. That's how we balance each other. That's why I'm here.
Kind of the yin and yang of weird.
The point was that this guy was looking for answers. Mm-hmm. I've never had a kind of experience like that, life-changing or threw me for a loop. So my quest for answers comes from a different place, and maybe not as deep as his. Or yours or Walter's, and Walter's talked about stuff that's happened to him.
That or you just haven't dug deep enough.
Maybe not, but I don't think you can make these experiences.
No,
they just happen.
No, they just happen. But what you do find out, it's a very curious thing, you know, is that it's almost like we have different histories stacked on top of each other, and some of that history is hidden from us. That sounds bizarre. Right. You ever find yourself remembering something that you never remembered before, and you don't even have a context to remember it in? Like, well, when? Oh, I remember that, but when did that happen? Where did that happen?
Yeah,
you ever have those
I do, but they're all mundane things.
Yeah, but even if they're mundane, it still is like this window that just opened of a piece of your life that you didn't even know existed.
I think it happens more as you get older, like as you maybe pass 60 or 70.
Oh, ease up on us 63-year-olds.
I wasn't making that second childhood thing. For some reason, your brain starts to download all the stuff that's been sitting in there doing nothing for 40 or 50 or 60 years.
Yeah, that's true. It is true. I mean,
I've heard from many people.
Yeah, it's funny. And having arrived at that part of the arc of whatever my life is, something changes. The way we're programmed, the way we program ourselves, however our culture has us, whatever it is. You're a lot more reflective. You're a lot more pulling things up, kind of pulling the reels from the past and reviewing them or looking them over, and kind of mining them for insights. Insights into, still who you are or why you did what you did. I don't know. It's a process I've noticed progress as I've gotten longer along in life.
Yeah. The original question was, though, what is your, and I'm glad you answered that question about the original interest, but what was the genesis of the interest in the government UFO thing? Because that's, when I met you, I think that's what we started talking about almost immediately.
Well.
Because of the stuff that was going on, I guess, with you right then.
Yeah, well, I guess because when I got involved, decided to go beyond just reading about UFOs in the late 80s, as I kind of found myself just spontaneously sort of getting interested in this stuff again, just find myself at bookstores looking for books on this subject. And at the time, the pickings were pretty lean. It was very interesting, in the late 80s. I mean, it's not like now where you can go into even Barnes & Noble's and you'll find 40 or 50 books with UFO topics or 20 or 30.
I never had problems finding UFO books. I'd go to used bookstores.
Yeah, I wasn't that hip yet. I didn't think there were old books. I mean, I knew a few of them. Scully and
so
a few.
You go
of
there,
those.
And there's a whole section.
Yeah, and
most of my UFO
out.
Collection comes from used bookstores.
Well, there seemed to be more 10 years before. I know what you're talking about. It seemed like in the late 70s, going into the 80s, there were a lot more UFO books, and they were in kind of they were nuts and bolts UFO books. And then in the 80s is when the New Age slant took over. So
yeah,
by the late 80s,
right.
Everything was this. This are brothers from Zeta Reticuli, and it was all spiritual and New Agey. So there certainly weren't a lot of government UFO books at all in the late 80s. That was something that I think very few people were.
Well, what it is you start to look at this subject, and you look at the history of it, and you look at the prominent mythologies, which was of course the most prominent mythology had been burst on the pop scene with Bill Moore's book and Berlitz's books. And we begin to hear more and more about Roswell again, and of course when you hear Roswell, you hear about, a cover up, and it's right away it's a cover up. And, and when people, almost the second question people ask after they ask if you believe in UFOs is, do you think the government's covering up stuff about UFOs? So we always go to the government like, what's daddy really doing,
Well, that's the angle that I've talked about on here ad nauseum. Everybody's heard it, but basically where, after years of interest, where I'm coming from is that I believe a majority of what people are seeing is actually our advanced technology either being tested or already applied. Certainly not 100% of what's out there.
Well, see, that's what makes it tricky. And as you capture people's interest, or people's interest comes to you, or like I teach now, and parents of students or students go, they want to give me like the soundbite answer, what's the story of UFOs, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. And you think it's government, or you think it's or aliens, or, and it's like, I don't know. First of all, and I don't think it's an either or. I think it's
The answer is
it's
yes.
Both.
Yes,
it's both. The question is to what degree, which one?
Yeah, and how much does the government know? I mean, I'm sure. I'm not sure. I can't be sure of anything. But from my experience and talking extensively to, to people, retired people from the aerospace industry, and talking to. Retired military and active military, it's a very very delicate subject, and it's prominent, and it's very compartmentalized that you get, which only piques your interest.
Sure.
But it takes a while. as far as information coming out of the government concerning UFOs, let's face it, they're holding all the cards. You know, I often make this point to my kids. If I were to say to you, you know, say to Greg, go stand in the middle of this football stadium. And then I looked around the stadium and I said, please, everybody, here is a picture of Greg, and I put it up on the big screen. Now, find Waldo, find Greg. And Greg's standing in the middle of the field right there. I mean, everybody just points and goes, there he is. Look, that's him. There he is. Yeah. It'd be pretty simple to identify. But if I did the same thing and put a picture of Greg up on the big screen, then I said, okay, find Waldo, find Greg. And I had 1,000 people standing on the field, all dressed the same, and said, okay, which one is Greg? You know, it'd be a crapshoot.
Oh, yeah. You know, they'd have to look. They'd have to work for the answer.
Right, you have to work for the answer. And it's the same thing coming out of the government, I think. You know, if you encounter intelligence, you know, people go, oh, look, if there were really UFOs and the government knew about it, it will leaked out by now. And I go, hello? It's leaked all over the blooming place. You know, it's leaking so badly, it's like a sieve. But the government can just pump more and more stuff into it so you can't tell what's real and what's not.
That's the thing. I would venture to say there's as much, if not more, controlled leak info as there is the oops, that shouldn't have leaked out kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, and of course the oops, it shouldn't have leaked out is sort of like the girl who, oops, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to show you that much.
Exactly.
You know, well, what are your intentions here? You know?
Well, do you think that's because that the government knows something and knows what's going on? Or certain elements of it do, they know something and know what's going on, but don't know what to do about it, which is my theory, and that's why the secrecy.
I would, again, to take you back to the stance we had before, I don't think it's or, I think it's and. I know it sounds contradictory, but I do. I think they know a certain amount. They sure don't feel comfortable. You know, and depending on how you interpret information, I think
I should have said and. Yeah. I mean, I think we take it for granted that there's an interest in intelligence and in the military and all that and other places. But what I think is debatable is how much and why depending on the how much, what is the incentive to release any information? There isn't any really because it can be used one as a power play, like we know more than you and we have it under control. And two, we don't really know anything. We don't have it under control, and we don't want to admit that. That's my working hypothesis.
Well, I think it's obvious over the course of this thing, probably going back as far as Roswell and probably before that, that there was concern with not being able to control your skies, and there was definitely craft flying around that ahead of the technology we had, especially in the 40s. Now, was that alien technology? That would be a quick assumption people would make, but not necessarily. I mean, we don't know. I mean, there are people who do know, I'm sure, but we don't know. You know, the only thing that makes me think that there must be some intelligence that's operating, you know, on the periphery and intelligently playing peekaboo with us is because that's the way it plays out. If you just stand back and look at it, it's a peekaboo game. I'm sure if we would know more if those intelligences wanted us to know more. And if our government felt it was healthier for us to know about the situation, healthier for the country as a whole, if it was a strategy to protect us from this knowledge or to inoculate us from the damage from this knowledge, they would be doing that job too. And maybe what the long-term program is to kind of inoculate us in a way and condition us to whatever the information turns out to be. You know,
and how's that being done, do you think?
That's a good question. Only the people who are calling the shots would know. I think it's done a million ways. I think it's done through leaked information, leaked real information, leaked false information, very subtle and nuanced and perhaps even direct influence of books and movies to point us in a certain direction. I mean, the government's involvement with Hollywood is as long as Hollywood is, just about. And, you know, doing wartime, I mean, you know, I grew up also going to those 50s movies like the the Battle of the Coral Sea, you know, these kind of real patriotic movies about wartime, which was all propagandized to build support for the war, you know. I think the government and you know, that greater task force document, the CIA document that Bill Gates had commissioned, the document that
the
was...
The openness document?
Yeah, the task force
the
for greater CIA openness. So they commissioned a study that Gates did on how the CIA could project an image of being more open to the American people, which even the stating of it kind of makes you go, God, I feel so manipulated just by the statement. It's like you're already manipulating us. You know, and so they report that goes out, and then it comes back, and if you, people have read copies of the report. In fact, we used a copy of the report in the first article I wrote for you in National Security Part 1, or Part 2.
Well, we'll get into where we got that from.
Yeah. You know, they say we have a great relationship with the media that's allowed us to kill stories, change stories. You know, it's been a very strong...
Hold them for a while.
Hold them for a while, all that stuff. And they're kind of bragging on their control of the media. They also brag about their relationship with... big business and the relationship with academia, you know. So, you know, the UFO subject would fall under the purview of our intelligence services and the CIA, at least at that time, and probably to some extent this time, although it's probably been taken over by, you know, the NSA or whatever reconfiguration they would do. I would think it's, that's how they would do it. They would, you know, like encouraging certain points of view or releasing certain information or, you know, just... putting their own little slant on something. I thought the like in the Independence Day movie when the story goes that the Air Force was very cooperative in making the movie until they the filmmaker said, well, we want to use the name Area 51 in this place in the desert, and the Air Force says, well, we'll be happy to cooperate, but you can't use that term, you can't use that name.
Even though that's not the official name.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. It's sort of like almost by saying you can't do it, they're almost building its reputation, and and it's sort of like
that's
the game. You know, like let's make people believe that even more by saying, oh, it's so important you can't even use it in your movie.
Right.
Yeah, that's the irony in there. The Air Force is very image conscious. Believe me, it's and so that's when you say that, that's immediately what comes to my mind as an Air Force veteran. It's like, oh God, there's that image consciousness again.
Yeah.
Oh no, the connotation, but. That cat's been kind of out of the bag for decades now on association with the Air Force.
Oh, yeah,
so,
right.
But they, you know, James Cameron, when I was an agent in L.A. in 94 to 96, we did a protective service operation on Sheila Widnall. And one night she was invited to Cameron's yacht in Marina Del Rey because he was developing a U.S. Air Force TV series and had invited her to this party, and the whole party was to, you know, warm up to her, and because he was talking with the Air Force. And the reason that the series didn't happen was a very, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a very similar thing. There was one aspect that the Air Force said, oh, no, sorry, we can't be part of that, because it all had to do with image. And it wasn't a negative thing, I don't really. But that was it. That was the.
But they didn't control that part of it, or they wanted control of it, and they didn't want to seem like they're exercising control. They just said no.
And that was the deal killer.
Wow. Well, okay.
Top Gun originally was supposed to be Air Force, from what I understand,
The
Air Force said nope. If we can't control it, so they went Navy.
Oh, interesting. But it's true that the Army, especially when you get in those ranks up there, high up, when as you advance in your career, the reason you advance is you've learned to play the game the way they want it played. You know, having been a young officer and getting out as soon as I could, and them going, well, yeah, you can have a great career in the military. And I'm going, no, why? So they just, you know, stifles individuality and creativity, and they're going, Creel, what? Creel, huh? Who? What? What? Creel, what?
What
are you talking
mean?
About, boy? You know? And they don't seem to get it. It's like, you know, it's like any corporation. We're going to shape you. And if you become one of our fillies, you know, you end up as boss of this corporation. You go, yeah, but who wants to be the boss of this corporation? You know, if I were boss of this corporation, it'd be much different. But you're not going to get to the top heading there if you clearly want to make it different all the way up the line, you know. It's self-perpetuating, you know. It's a very self-perpetuating system. Much like Hollywood is, much like all big institutions are.
Yeah.
But to go back to the issue of the government and UFOs, I think you can't help but have to go back and say, well, what does our government know? Because they're the ones that, you know, have from stories we've had, like the Roswell story, oh, it crashed there and they recovered it there, but then it was a weather balloon there, then there was secret flights, and then there was people being threatened, and then the government's involved all over the place, you know, and all these cases come up, and you look at the cases in Montana and South Dakota with the nuclear weapons storage areas being compromised by glowing lights hovering over the field, and then our nuclear missiles being sequentially disarmed, you know, at several of our major underground installations. And again, that even could be American technology. It could be, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Maybe they were testing some new craft and ability to, you know, manipulate nuclear weapons. I mean, who knows?
Well, the whole thing was an exercise. I haven't heard that angle yet presented.
Yeah.
But there's a book us three should write, guys.
What was
Roswell and all this was an exercise.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about some of the nuclear...
All that, throw it all in. It's all been exercises.
Well, if you read Fated Giant, which was written by Robert Salas, who was in the Malmstrom case, he said that they... I don't think so, because eventually when you do an exercise... Well, if you take it as far up as you want. But eventually when you do an exercise, somebody involved with it, they got to do a debriefing.
Right.
So that later, as a result of the exercise, they know not to make whatever mistake they made.
But there could be, you know, there could be classified exercises too.
That's true. Remember the ones about going on the submarine? But then they told it breaking into the nuclear submarine, the special force.
Oh yeah,
but then they told them about it later.
Yeah, and there was hearings on it, and the admirals whose nuclear submarines had been taken over by the SEAL teams had gone into as a test to see if they could be taken over that easily by terrorists. You know, just these submarines parked like in Chesapeake Bay or down here at Coronado, and it was like a test they were assigned to do. It was under Richard Marcinko to go and see if they could take over a submarine. And they did it quite easily, which was very upsetting and very disturbing to those guys whose promotion has just been somewhat thinned, you know, possibilities because, gee, look, under your command, you know, terrorists took over your submarine.
So that's who Marcinko pissed off.
Oh, yeah, Marcinko pissed off. Yeah, Marcinko pissed those people off really bad. I mean...
At some point I'll have Salas on and he can explain that because I've had lunch with him. He lives up in Ojai. Very nice guy. He's reading Project Beta right now. He was in the Minuteman missile silo when apparently floated over there, shut down in two different areas, I think almost 20 missiles.
Yeah. Now,
I tend to believe it wasn't an exercise.
I tend to believe it wasn't an exercise either, and I tend to believe it wasn't American or, you know,
Russian.
But who knows? I mean... Who knows for sure, but if we just take it, let's say, in a conventional, less paranoid approach to it, I mean, just the evidence suggests that there is some intelligence who's, you know, making a big point by shutting down nuclear weapons, and that point could
be... Well, that's what Salas thinks.
Right, there could be two different points they're making. One is, don't try it, it's useless, you know. I think it's more about, get off the nuclear tit.
Ah, there's other things out
there. Yeah, don't do this to this, you know, this environment, you know.
Well, why doesn't anything happen when, you know, I've got an answer for this, but why doesn't anything happen when everybody's got their finger on the trigger like in the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, we don't know what would have happened, do we?
Yeah,
we don't know that something didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
How much less close were we to these things when missiles were shut down in silos?
That might have brought things to a head for a certain intelligence saying, you know, how close they came.
Maybe we didn't know. Maybe there was something going on at that point.
Well, exactly.
They were on alert.
A two-sided question for you on this topic is, go back 100 years or so when we had Nikola Tesla clearly doing the things he was doing. Now, number one, my first question that came to mind, and then a second one popped into my head, my first question was, well, then wait a minute, his stuff is a lot safer in most ways than nuclear technology and the stuff that was developed instead of his. Why didn't they intervene then and say, yes, listen to this guy? And then I thought, wait a minute, maybe back then some of the stuff he was doing was potentially dangerous. Is this why Tesla was ostracized? Is maybe this why Tesla was almost made a non-person?
I think he was ostracized because of money.
Well, yeah, I agree with you on that. That's probably
the other thing
I
don't know if there's an intelligence sitting around controlling.
But why didn't
our
aliens
history
or whoever shut down our missiles?
Yeah.
That's my question to you: is what do you think about why they didn't appear?
We're making assumptions
in
here on
Tesla.
The show.
Well, yeah, this is
aliens.
It's
that
all
are
assumptions.
It's all assumptions. It's like a roaming conversation. You know, let me, you know, go home, forget about it.
I just wanted to make it clear that we're not saying this week because we think there's aliens here controlling our history.
No.
We are kicking ideas around, which is what we do on this show.
Speak for yourself, Greg.
You know, it's the kind of conversation you know, you guys have over a beer. And you can see how hard it is to control this conversation. You know, it's a what-if conversation. You know, it's a what-if conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we're having that what-if conversation says to me that, you know, our attention is being drawn into thinking about certain things in certain areas, you know, and they stubbornly keep refusing to go away. You know, it's not like this. We're describing, oh, there was this time when this craft crashed, let's say 47,
right.
And we're curious to what happened back there because nothing like that has happened since. I wonder what that was. Now, what we have is an ongoing sort of peekaboo game going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether it's the government covering its own secret technology, but I think it's more like one hand washes the other. You know, it's so convenient, you know, you can go, oh, let the people think it's a UFO when it's something we're experimenting and developing. And vice versa, if there is a threat or, a real intelligence operating behind this phenomena that the government does not feel in control of, you know, it allows people to feel safe that, oh, yeah, sure, there's no aliens, that's just a secret craft. You know, it's our new technology. It's You know, and the CIA even kind of lends support to that when it says, oh, yes, we've used the UFO issue to cover the U-2 flights, right?
Mm.
And it's going, okay. You know, but depending on what you want people to buy, say you as an OSI agent, your assignment was to get people to buy this brand of bread. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd be doing everything you in power to sell
sure.
and convince people that that's the brand of bread they want to be eating, right? Because
right.
that's your job, that's your mission, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can have different groups operating with opposite missions, you know, and maybe somebody at the top pulling strings on both sides, just you know, keeping the conversation ramming this way and that, and also keeping the people in the middle of it confused.
Sure.
I just find it interesting to think of the redundancies that are happening behind this subject. You know, if the Navy has its experiences with the phenomenon, and the Air Force has its experiences with the phenomenon, and the Army has its experiences with the phenomenon, and they have their own intelligence things, their own research going, and they're jealous of the other ones, and they all resent the CIA and the civilian controls, and how much duplication and compartmentalization is going on that, by the way, we're partially financing, not 100% financing, because they're smart enough to take our money and through that create legitimate businesses, which create more money. You know, so we don't even know how much funding is behind this stuff. It could be so astronomical it defies description. Because,
well,
you know, it's big bucks.
It is
to
in a lot
use.
Of ways. If there's a
oh,
couple
yeah.
of different books on that, on the black budget, and I can't remember the titles of them right now, but...
Yeah, money makes money.
Right.
I find it fascinating that, for instance, one of the largest...
Defense,
insurance companies.
Oil, banking, and weapons, oil, banking, and drugs are the biggest money makers.
Yeah, yeah, and how do you move money around? You know, and the CIA was absolutely authorized in the 1980s to create front companies. It was made legal for them to create front companies to function for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's anything in that law that said that you can't make them profitable. And you sure can use them to launder money and move money around the world. And we know that money's moving around through the intelligence services every day, you know. So as far as I think that we provide the seed money through our taxes for a lot of these things. And that seed money gets converted into huge amounts of legitimate operations, the proceeds of which go back into these black projects and this kind of shadowy, you know, influencing of the world. You know, and then you think of different agencies all having their own little funds and their own little programs.
Wouldn't it be funny if it turned out that some of these cover companies that are under the black budget, the seed money for them that make these profits, you know, actually made money and gave it back to the U.S. government instead of being the big evil money takers?
Well, yeah, and to a large extent, that's partly why they were created in a way, but not to go back into the public coffers and say, you know, okay,
oh, no, definitely to go
yeah.
back into the.
Here's
black
more
budget.
Money for public education.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Here's more money for the new laser. You know.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, just talking to people who retire from the aerospace industry, you know,
sure.
you realize how much earlier we had certain things than when the public found out about them. You know, I have a one retired fellow. I don't want to say anything more than that, but he worked on many of these covert projects. He worked on the SR-71's, camera package that came out of the bottom to take all the photographs when they were flying over, wherever they were flying over. He was materials supervisor, so he had, you know, great control, had to talk to everybody in the project. He worked on the ion propulsion drive, you know. And his brother, and this is kind of an indirect giveaway, but so it is, his brother had worked at Lawrence Livermore, very high up. And his brother, in fact, spent 6 years working on the new particle accelerator on the Swiss-French border.
Cool.
Unfortunately, he finished that 6 years of work and said he's on his way home and called his brother and said, okay, I'm on my way home, I'm done. 6 years, I'm done, I'm coming home. And died of a heart attack in the Geneva airport you know, it's very disturbing. And what I find more disturbing is that his brother, whom I know well, is retired, old man, is working these projects. His brother is very suspicious about his brother's death. He says that he's seen that scenario too many times.
That's one
of
those weird scientist deaths that have been going on.
Exactly. And he said he saw engineers and scientists terminated after projects to keep them secret. You know, he knew about those stories. He worked his way out of those projects as fast as he could.
The railgun people, a bunch of people around that turned up suicided or dead.
Well, not to mention the old SDI thing with the British.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that's ever been satisfactorily exposed, understood. I don't think people really understand the implications of that, because that's way beyond coincidence. You know, you cannot have that many coincidences.
How many was it with the SDI thing with the Brits?
Somewhere in the 20s, 20-something.
Yeah, it was...
27 or something like that?
I've only heard about that a very little bit, but I remember when I saw the number, I was like, what?
Yeah, it's like... it's like, you know, this is a very bifurcated world, you know, that where... We live at one level of technology that is being slowly delivered to us, while behind the scenes, they've had that technology for a long time.
Well, magnetic swipe technology cards, and politics and everything.
Which is probably where Tesla actually went to. Publicly, he was, forget this guy, you know, just forget him. But privately, because we know that the Navy, even the ONI and stuff, scooped up
his papers, just like FBI scooped up Reich's papers,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I find it fascinating, too, that, say these free energy machines and all these ideas people have for new propulsions, or even for making, improvements in gas mileage, that the patent office can go, no, we won't patent that because that's just ridiculous. You know?
Yeah.
No, we won't give you a patent for that.
Well,
which pretty effectively kills a lot of things, right? I mean, we live in a completely massaged, manipulated environment as far as this goes. You know, it's not like... We're really living in a free enterprise. You know, I got a great idea. Let me make it available to everybody. Oh, there it is. Now, if you have a great idea that harms big
powerful
interests...
Well, as long as it's frozen yogurt or something, it's
fine.
Yeah,
I mean, if it's going to harm big financial interests, you're going to find yourself, on the bottom end of somebody's heel.
Well, the thing to do is to not try to get it patented, not try to compete with them. The thing to do, and you just can't get people to do this, least of all Americans... that is,
it's just give it away.
Spread this around. People just use it anyway. Don't blab about it. Don't go on damn radio shows and TV and say, hey, look what I'm using. Just use it, and then as it spreads, they won't be able to stop it.
Don't you think there's a little bit of a movement like that happening right now?
I think so.
I do.
There's a lot of people out there that are doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, I do.
Tesla had that thing on his car that... he didn't have
the electric car
these tubes, on the thing. And there's a lot of people out there, I think, that are quietly doing.
It's always the timing is so interesting. It's like, you know, one of the debates that went on back in the late 80s into the 90s, and coming like out of Bob Lazar, was Lazar for real, or was Lazar being used? Did Lazar know he was being used, et cetera, et cetera. Again, we can endlessly speculate, but we never know. You know, we'll never know. And having taken a real close look at that with Don Ecker, and actually having spent time with Lazar and interviewed him and been to his house several times and looked at the photographs hanging on the wall of his bathroom where he's posing with bunches of other people, some of them who are quite interesting. One person I know had told me to make a point of going to the bathroom if I got to Lazar's house and into the other room, not a bathroom, but the room next to the bathroom also, where he kind of has his Tesla coil, that kind of stuff. And they're framed photographs.
Did at the time in Vegas.
Yeah, in Vegas. But there's some pretty interesting photographs. A pretty interesting collection of characters in those photographs. So, one with a nice Yakuza symbol on his hand, it's hard to know what really went on there.
Did you come away from going and looking at this stuff in the bathroom, and why were you... And we can talk about who told you this as the show goes on.
Mm-hmm.
What did you come away from by being told to look at these things? What did you bring away with you? What was different when you left Lazar's house?
Well, I couldn't decide what Lazar knew about what he went through.
Because he didn't know, you think, or because...
I don't think... From what I get, whatever he thinks he went through, he thinks he went through.
Right.
How that was orchestrated
is
something
question.
Else.
Yeah.
My suspicion is that You know, sometimes agendas are stacked. One incident, one thing can serve several agendas, kind of stacked agendas.
Right.
And I think
so.
That
somebody
might be
trying
example.
To get to the main one is following the wrong branch.
Right. Exactly. And a good example is the book you wrote with Beta. You know, we find out that the whole Benowitz case was a misdirection play to hide a technology we were developing at the time, and you know,
a couple of technologies.
But look how high it went. Look at the effort they went through with the NSA providing him with software and enrolling this guy into a whole false reality. We're talking about government operations, and they're like, where's Waldo? Standing in the middle of the field, you know, well, how would you know? Here's your own government saying, yes, yes, here's some software. Help us with this, and we're going to keep track of this. It's like there's no conscience involved there, it's, you know, at all. There's no need to tell the truth. It's like, oh, of course we don't tell the truth. The whole idea is to lie because we're protecting very important secrets, you know.
I think there's a level of conscience because having I was in shortly after the classic Doty era, we'll call it. When I was in, his reputation as presented to me was somewhat checkered, and I think that is a direct result of all, well, I know it is, of all that crap he did back then with that. He did not make the higher-ups happy, so...
Well, you know, it's easy for the higher-ups to say that when it's all over and done with and say, oh, yes, what a tawdry and what a terrible thing and what a jerk he was. However, I don't think the higher-ups did anything about it at the time.
Well, I think that's how he got in trouble was...
He got in trouble in West Germany, East German border. Everybody says he stole money or something like that. My understanding was that he revealed a little bit too much to somebody they were trying to pull over on to their side from East Germany.
On unauthorized personnel.
Right.
Kind of thing. Well, but see, we don't know exactly how much he got in trouble for the Benowitz thing.
Right.
That might have been...
That's what I'm talking about.
What
the
hell
thing.
Are you doing? Okay, on to the next assignment, one more thing, and you're in trouble, buddy. And the thing Greg is referring to was the final straw.
Well, I see that, but know. Here's the question I have. This NSA created and provided software.
Right.
Now, to go from Doty to the NSA, mm-hmm. there's got to be some links in between, mm-hmm. a chain of command.
Absolutely.
That goes pretty high up.
Well, Doty didn't give him the software.
But it was part of that operation to
there are more than a couple, according to my understanding, there was more than one agency, and Walter has confirmed this, that when there's a special circumstance, agencies will cooperate.
Oh, yeah.
Like the CIA,
well, that's
the
my
NSA,
point.
Whatever, yeah. Will say, we have purview over this. Could you help us out with this and give us some information? And then the NSA, apparently the NSA, whose project it was that Benowitz was listening to with his radio,
mm-hmm.
had somebody create a computer, not just software, but a whole computer with the software loaded on it. Delivered to his house, and Bill Moore told me it was delivered by A.J. Allen Hynek, but I've never been able to substantiate that.
That would really be interesting.
But there is usually a lot of coordination.
But that's my point. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, well, he should never have done that, you know. It's like the kid with Abu Ghraib, you know, oh, those corporates should never have treated those people that way. Like, they thought up the idea, you know. I just don't buy that. I don't think Doty thought up the idea, you know, and somehow, you know, is just like, oh, if we had known he was doing this, we would have stopped him. You know, no,
well, I can,
you know,
no. My understanding is he was reacting to what Benowitz was doing, and when it was further away from what they wanted him not to look at, he would encourage it, and if it was closer to it, they would discourage it. And since they had his trust, he would listen to them. Unfortunately, the stuff that brought his attention further away was the crazier stuff, so he kept going in that direction. Oh yes, there's an underground base. Oh yes, you know. Like, why don't you help us out with this? Not, I'm still hearing signals coming from, you know, from the base. I'm still seeing lights fly around. I'm still seeing base. No, it's further away from the base, and the further away from their business they could get him was fine. And that extrapolated him more and more into crazy territory.
Right.
And he should have been coordinating that with up his chain every step.
Well, I bet he was, but the whole thing is, I don't think they cared about his state of mind. All they cared about, and you've just been talking about this, is keeping him away from the stuff.
Right.
And keeping an eye on him to see who was coming to him to find out what he was looking at.
Right.
You know, some guy saying, oh, I'd like to know about this UFO stuff. Check his background.
But Richard makes a good point, and that's what I was backing up, is every step along the way, he should have been briefing and coordinating his bosses, and they would have been briefing Region, and then Region would have been briefing headquarters, So, yeah, he was getting blessings from above.
Exactly.
If he wasn't, I'm guessing it wouldn't have gone as far, would have
right.
been shut down a lot sooner.
That's my point.
Than it did.
You know, it's like
the,
it's impossible to separate Doty out as if he's some kind of outlaw. I can't think of the word I want right now, but, you know, just
Maverick.
Maverick, that's the word, you know, going back to Top Gun. But I don't buy it. I mean, again, that's, see, in the world of counterintelligence, you know, your food is lies. Your food is spin. You know, I mean, that's what you feed people. You feed people lies. You feed people spin. You're counterintelligence. That's what it means.
Particularly in
operations. If you do your job well, you lie well.
Sure.
You sell your lie.
Absolutely.
That's what you do.
Yep.
You know, so it's no wonder we all kind of look at the UFO stuff in the government and go, can't trust those bastards. Well, you know, they're not trustworthy. I mean, they're professionally trained to lie. You know, it's like the time when Don Ecker and I took the STS-48 shuttle footage onto Larry King, and they sent Baby Huey. I mean, Jim Oberg, excuse me. my apologies to Baby Huey. You know, so, you know, they always have to provide a counterpoint to outlandish things, you know, like, you know, the two-headed baby, they got to have a doctor on
no,
the
show. No, you know. You can see that it's obviously a chunk of ice.
Yes. So, you know, STS-48 footage, there's some interesting things of lights rising through the atmosphere and then, you know, drifting to the left, and then, you know, the screen kind of blossoms for a second. You're looking at the exterior video cameras looking back at the Earth, right? And then you see the whole screen kind of blossom for a second, and then from the lower left, streaking up to exactly where that UFO was, is a little streak going across the screen like a meteorite, you know? And you see this light in the distance stop, and then shoot off to the atmosphere, and Stan McDaniels had the footage analyzed by Jack Kasher, the physicist at the University of Nebraska, to say, well, are we looking at little particles being thrown around by the little hydrazine jets on the outside of the shuttle that Jim Oberg is telling us that we're just seeing little flecks of ice and debris being blown around in front of the camera, and we can't tell the distance, and they're behaving that way because the jets are blowing them around. And that's all it is, folks. That's all it is. There's no UFO being shot at by some kind of weapon or particle beam. I mean, come on. You know, it's like, well, we should believe them.
It might have been a test.
It could be a test. It could
with
be
with a dummy target.
With a dummy target, it could be anything. But the point is, whatever it was,
it wasn't
they
ice.
Wanted to kill it, you know, and they wanted to say it was ice being blown around, you know.
Whatever it was,
cover story.
It wasn't
it's the weather balloon. It's the inverted swamp gas. It's the, you know, it's you can't believe your own lying eyes, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, we have lots of footage of this stuff. So, you know, they provide footage, and Larry King picks it up, and it shows particles floating out of the bay and spinning around, things like this. And it shows these particles at stage separation flowing around. And you go, see? And you go, yeah, I see. I really do see. I see articles. I see those particles. I see them being blown around. They look like particles being blown around.
You see what you want to see.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with this over here? This doesn't even seem remotely the same. They're not behaving the same way. They're not spinning the same way. You
right.
can tell they're right there in front of you. Mm-hmm. This, you can tell it's real far away. I mean, the idea, they go, oh, yeah, this, you know, no, this just this. And the only way, you know, to gain the upper hand with somebody like that, because they're the official and you're the one making the outrageous claims, is to discredit him. And so that's what we did, you know. And the only way to do that is to back him in the corner, as I would any intelligence agency who is speaking about, you know, something that they're supposedly, you know, dissing, is go, tell me something. If this were true, Mr. Oberg, Baby Huey, and this is what I had Don do to him on the show. I was off stage kind of feeding Don, you know, off stage, and he'll verify this. We discussed ahead of time how to trap him. Is say, look, suppose this were true. Suppose there were, you know, this horrible secret that we're shooting at UFOs. We're at war with the UFOs. Or are we testing a new technology, you know, to fight? Could you talk about it if it was highly classified? Well, no, of course not. And if NASA has classified missions, which we know they have many, you know, shuttle missions, and they're doing classified stuff, that's what it means to be classified. It means you can't talk about it. You have to, you know, mum's the word. And if you're asked about it, you have to deny it. And if confronted more, you have to lie about it. So tell me, you're here saying this footage, which doesn't look like this footage you claim it's supposed to look like, it doesn't look the same. If it looked the same, I'd go, oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, it's just the coat on the back of the chair in the night that made me think it was a ghost in my room. You know, I see now in that light of day, it was my jacket. But it wasn't that simple. You know,
right.
The difference in the footage was dramatically different. And so you have to go out there. Well, wait, you're telling us we're looking at this. Why should we believe you? When if we were looking at this, you'd have to lie about it. You'd have to cover it up. You'd have to stand here and say just what you're saying. Only you'd be lying. So how do we know then? Are you lying? Are you telling the truth? Are you smart? Or are you dumb?
Was he able to get enough of that out so that Oberg could, before somebody interrupted him?
Well, it was perfect. I didn't warn Don about this. I said, look, you're going to get a big reaction to this because now you're pushing him, poking him where there's no place for him to go. You've got him in a corner. And when people are cornered, watch out. And I said, probably what he's going to do is going to turn around and attack you personally, you know, an ad hominem attack.
Or Larry's going to interrupt him.
And, Larry tried to interrupt him, but Don just wouldn't let him. In fact, when Larry went to a commercial, he went, whoa, we'll be back with the Don Eckers show in just a minute. You know, Don was driving hard, doing a really good job of pushing the point and not letting him escape.
So how did the guy
react? He reacted just as I predicted, like a cornered rat. He says, well, at least I'm not here trying to sell UFO magazines.
Oh, you know, like a child.
Yeah, and so, but I told Don, I said, now when he does that, I want you to use this word because, I said, I want you to say, if you want to make ad hominem attack, that's one thing. He goes, ad word? Ad hominem, it's a debate term. When you can't attack the argument, you attack the man. And you see it every day on Fox
And he said
News.
This on the air, too.
Right.
Oh,
so beautiful. Don goes, well, if you want to make ad hominem attack, that's one thing. You know, and meanwhile, you cut to Baby Huey, and now he's like, his face is all red, you know, he's pulsing, you know, his eyeballs are spinning, right. Like, ding, 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 you know. He's pissed. He's been caught. And, let's go back to the footage. And so we go to the commercial, and he says, we'll be back with the Don Ecker show in just a minute.
Beautiful.
And he comes back, and he tries to show us this kind of footage, and it's like, well, you know, let the footage speak for itself. I mean, let the people make their own decision.
Yeah.
You know. But, again, how do you trust any of these people when their business is to protect these secrets? You know, I mean, it's like, a father, my job is to protect my family. How far will I go to protect my family? Well, I'll only know when I get there, as far as I have to.
Yeah.
You know, as far as I have to. So if you're assigned this job, how far will you go to protect these secrets? As far as I have to. That's my mission. That's my job. You know? So it's a very complicated, and talk to people, covert operatives and things like this. You know, these guys put
themselves
out there.
Richard, then why do you talk to them if they're lying all the time? I got this question today, and I want to hear your answer.
Well, because, first of all, you're not necessarily talking to them like you were in a specific case, like talking to Dodie about, well, what was the truth about the Benowitz case?
Right, right.
Sometimes, you develop a relationship with these people, and you range over a broad range of subjects,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
You know, it takes place
your
over a long period of time.
Your answer comes when you're talking about somebody's golf game or something, you know?
Vraiment. Exactement.
You guys make good handling agents.
I had to get this through to people on this radio show today. Why do you listen to such liars like Doty and Richard, Richard Doty and Robert Collins and Moore and all those people? I said, well, Moore because he's a friend of mine and I trust him and he hasn't lied to me ever. And the other two, because if you don't play the game, you get nothing.
You got to play the game. You know, you got to play the game.
Why play that game? It's like, well, you know what? Because it's interesting to me, and I've gotten some answers I wanted.
And
you may never hear about them, and I don't care.
And if you really want to know, whoever's asking that question, why do we talk to these people? Well, we're doing it for you too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you want to know, you don't feel like you have the skills to separate the wheat from the chaff. You don't feel like there's something to be gained. You don't feel like you can risk it. You feel that castrated that you don't think you get anything useful from it. The boogeyman. Ooh.
When I say I don't care, I mean I don't care that you think that I'm withholding something from you because I'm doing something else. I'm playing this game. It's for me. And if something comes out of it that I think is valuable, you'll be damn sure that I'll say something about it.
Yeah.
But not until something's valuable that I think is going to help and is well-founded.
Yeah.
And that may be years.
Right.
And the other thing was, what if you never get an answer and they just run you in circles? It's like, well, I guess you have to take risks, don't you?
Yeah. And, you know, everything, you know, like if you're doing research or anything, if you're doing any investigative work.
Nothing may happen.
Yeah,
sorry.
Nothing may happen. You may end up running in circles. But you don't know until you go and do the investigation,
right, exactly.
You know?
And let's not try to fool anybody. All of us who do this stuff, we do it because we enjoy it. That's part of...
Keep your mouth.
Oh, okay. That's part of the thrill of it, is is it true, is it not, what's the answer, where do I find it, who's this guy? That's all part of it. We enjoy that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that game. See, I'm sitting here with two people that understand exactly what I'm talking about, so it's easier to say this. But, yeah, it's that, and Bill told me this a long, long time ago, I think before I met you. If you don't play the game, you get nothing.
Right.
If you play the game, there's a small chance you might get something.
Right, right. And that's
but
what
you know what? The game's interesting, too.
That's to be an investigative reporter, that's the way it is. You know, if you can do any investigating, you gotta investigate, and you gotta talk to people, and some are gonna lie to you, and some are gonna give you information, and some are gonna accidentally give you information. You know, the breadth as well as the depth of knowledge is very important, because sometimes things that are seemingly unrelated down the road turn out to be intimately connected, and maybe the two pieces of information you got, you may get three years apart. You know, you may get them 3 years apart. I mean, I have ranging conversations with this. This fellow right now, that you know, a retired guy, and we talk about everything from operations he was involved in, and human smuggling, and you know, being undercover in a human smuggling operation for several years, and you know, he will tell me things that happened to him in the time being undercover. You know, he'll tell me about the characters he was involved with it, and the different times we'll have a cup of coffee and laughing and talking about that. Maybe next minute we're talking about Dodger baseball. Next minute we're talking about something else, you know.
Right.
And then maybe 3 or 4 or 6 months later or a year later, we're talking about something else, and he refers back to this guy's name, and this guy's name is the guy he saved, and told me a whole story about him 2.5 years ago or a year and a half ago from a different point of view. But somehow the story ran to this story, and the same guy's name comes up, and then you go, well, okay, that was very consistent.
Yeah.
You know, it was very consistent.
Or even better, somebody else has told you the same story a week, a month, a year, or 10 years ago.
Yeah. So you have to do a lot of comparing and balancing, and as you know, a lot of information comes away that goes kind of into the suspense file. In fact, I'd say the biggest chunk of our information in this field goes into what we call the suspense file of the, file, you know? Well, I just put this over here, and who knows? You know, maybe down the road I'll hear something else about it, and I can pull it out and compare the information.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes where you make your most startling discoveries.
Yeah.
Don't you find?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And so it's like
I had about 10 of those during Project Beta.
Yeah.
And it was not because of stuff that I'd started thinking about when I did the book. It was stuff from 10 or 15 years before.
Right.
It suddenly made sense.
Yeah, that suddenly made sense. Stuff that Richard and I had been through, stuff that Bill and I had talked about. When we didn't even know I was going to write that book.
Yeah,
suddenly, wow, okay, that's what that means. But you talk to somebody who hasn't been through that and is reading your book with a critical, you know, some kind of, with an agenda and a critical eye. Critical eye, yes, agenda I don't think is necessary. It shouldn't be there. But, like, how did you find that out? How can you be sure? I can't explain it to you because, one, it's a very personal thing, and it's hard to explain. And two, if I did explain it to you, you would say, that's bullshit, because you haven't been through it.
Right.
And there's a few things like that in the book and other things I've written and stuff I talked about with you and Walter that we know because we took a long time to try and figure it out. And we made a connection. Well, so-and-so told me this, you know, 15 years ago. He referred to this guy being at this base at this time for this project.
Right,
and suddenly
right.
that name in that project comes up again, and somebody says, well, that was related to either unknowns or it was related to nuclear project or something like that. But suddenly now you know what this other weird thing was 10 years ago. It's not even as simple as that. But that's the way it is. It's almost an you have an intuition that snaps.
Right.
When a connection is made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes you have to go back and try and find the documentation.
Exactly.
To back up your intuition.
I know that somewhere I have something. I remember that. I got to go find it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, unfortunately, I mean, that's why, you know, you've done this for a long time and why you have something to say. You see, why it's of interest and why you have things to share, because you've spent your time, your life, your energy, you know, pursuing it. And it's a luxury for a lot of people. They can't do that. It's not a luxury because, you know, you've paid the price for it.
They're not interested. If somebody was, they would have probably done similar things to you. And maybe they do with their stamp collecting or whatever it is.
Exactly. You know, like you used to say about the UFO.
Whatever your axe is, you know, your tune that you're playing. Yeah, you know.
Like you say, well, you know, Don, like you say about UFO investigators, you know, well, everybody needs a hobby. Well, yeah, it's a great hobby, you know. It's kind of a fun hobby.
Yeah. I don't want to use hobby, but that's what it is for most people.
Yeah, well,
nobody's
what,
a professional ufologist except for maybe Stan Friedman and, right. and Linda Howe and
it's
maybe
kind of like
Whitley
we're not
Strieber.
Supposed to, but, we're not supposed to use the word bum anymore. We're supposed to say homeless or displaced. Or not. A bum's a bum. A hobby's a hobby. You know? I mean, by definition, what you like to do in your yeah. spare time that usually doesn't make you money.
Right.
You know, that's a hobby. And it's okay.
All right, Walter, do I get
we'll
to
take
ask
a break
you?
Here in a couple minutes
okay,
because I've got to change my CD over.
Mm-hmm. You served how many years in OSI?
Six.
6 years?
Uh-huh.
Were these subjects ever addressed, the subject of secret craft or of UFOs? Was ever part of your experience?
Many of us. Some of us talked about it many, many times. I mean, of course, you got guys in the first. You got guys in the Air Force, and then we're all in OSI, you know. So naturally, because OSI has popped up for a variety of reasons, you know, every detachment you go to has got your UFO guys, and I handled some UFO related things, not sightings reported in, but people coming to the Air Force. For information, or as I've alluded to on the show many times, I've looked at foreign UFO investigators working in the U.S. from the angle of are they actually collecting on Air Force technology? That was the concern.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that. We'll come back to that. Right.
But we talk about it all the time, but we talk about it also, particularly if you're in counterintelligence, which I was, and I had a pretty respectable clearance level because of this. You naturally learn things where you go, oh, okay, now I get what that is, right. or okay, now I get why they're doing that. And then, as I've said ad nauseum on this show, the guys in special projects in OSI, they're the kind
right.
of guys you're talking about
right.
that specifically are, their job is to protect the technology.
Right.
And they do a hell of a job.
They do a hell of a job. And I wouldn't want them to do a bad job.
No. Oh, no.
Oh, well, no. You could argue that that's what... Dodie Collins, Ernest Edwards, all those people were doing at Kirtland too.
Yeah, right. That's what I say. You have to give them. If that's your mission, that's yeah. your mission. You know, and you do your mission.
But most of us guys, or at least all the guys I know that were into that, we're all just like, and Greg and I have talked about. We're all just like you guys. We're interested in this stuff. We think it's cool that the public's interested in the you know the ET angle. If we know that it's Air Force technology we're protecting,
right.
we're gonna protect that. We totally understand why we're doing it. But the percentage that would not be, we're with you guys.
Right.
It's like, what is this stuff? Because nobody's telling us unless your duties on a particular day specifically confront that issue.
SCI.
It's the
right.
compartmentalization that you're
right.
talking about.
And
exactly.
that's what keeps elected officials out of the loop, too.
Sure, yeah.
Including the president, you know. It's like, well, you're not authorized to have that information. If you need it as president, we'll
you know,
give it to you.
I there was a time when I'd say, no, the president has got to know everything. I'm like, and I've, over time, like, nope. I'm sure there's stuff that some presidents have not been told.
I think it's quite political and quite different from president to president.
Yeah.
From what I've read and what
sure.
I understand is that it depends on who's in control of the information and how they feel about the guy they elected. And they
yeah.
see the elected officials as transitory. Guy
right.
serves 4 years or 8 years, he's gone. You know,
yeah, the Air Force
career,
is still there.
The
Army
Force
is
still
there.
The yeah. mission is still there. The long term mm-hmm. is still there. You
I
know,
just
the
think it's hilarious.
The secret is still there.
When they talk about, you know, which president will be the disclosure president, none of them.
None.
Yeah, right.
You know, this,
yeah.
I'm
don't hold your breath.
Yeah,
you know.
The nonsense that Obama's the disclosure president, you know, he's going to not be that any more than Bush was that, or Clinton, or his daddy, or Reagan, or anybody since the first one who knew.
Yeah, possibly, maybe. Hey, Walter.
Yeah.
And Richard. I'm going to leave a cliffhanger here because I want to turn my CD over because I'm recording this
Yay.
And I want to post it as soon as possible. When I
okay.
I'm going to discuss the server thing tomorrow with a friend.
Does that mean I have time to go smoke a cigarette?
Yes, you do.
How about that, folks?
I want Walter, even though Richard is our guest, because
yeah.
I think he'll be interested in the answer,
oh.
to tell me, and then we'll talk about what was going on in the 90s with the Navy and all that with you and I, you at first. And I've never asked Walter this. If you were in Doty's position with Benowitz and tasked with doing that, what would you have done? And I want you to answer that when we come back.
Okay.
And maybe with a kind of a critique, possibly, of what Doty had done. There's this big thing right now. Everybody's interested in MJ-12 and Moore and Doty and Robert Collins, and I don't know where it came from. It's this, like, mini craze going on for about the last week or two.
Probably because, like we've said also before, they're a little bit burnt out with where things have been, so it's fresh.
Our guest this week is Richard Saraday, and we'll be back. But we'll be right back with Richard Saraday and our co-host Walter Bosley talking about UFO secrecy and government stuff, and I seen him too and stuff like that.
Those Air Force bastards.
Radio Mysterioso.
Take us to your president. We've been tidings from the moon. At the rate our people breed, we've too many mouths to feed. We may be among you soon. Take us to your president. We've a growing rate of birth. We just sit around and moon, cause there's no more room to spoon by the light of yonder earth. Send us surplus of potatoes.
We're still here with Richard Saraday, our special guest, and Walter, our usual co-host. What? Act normal?
The abnormal, normal, usual, the abnormal, usual guy who sits in with you.
Yeah, you know what? I like your show, but that Walter guy, he's nuts, man. What's talking about this underground stuff?
Yeah, he sounds pretty level-headed and you know, practical and stuff till he starts talking about that Hollow Earth stuff and them people in there. Yeah, I know.
The question for Walter, yes, before we get back to our guest Richard here, mm-hmm, I posed before the break was, knowing what happened during the Benowitz period, reading the book, and actually helping me a little mm-hmm bit with OSI SOPs and stuff like that when I was doing the book, what would you have done in that situation to control that possible intelligence problem?
Okay. My only caveat, and even though people are going to hate this, but I'm sorry, my experience forces me to...
All right, we've got an AFOSI agent in here we can tie to a chair and grill.
The caveat is, short of having read the case file...
You don't know the parameters.
I haven't read the case file. You haven't read the case file.
Nope.
I've read your book.
Right.
And
that's the public case file.
Yeah.
And it's apparently sort of accurate.
Nobody in this room or anyone and listening, unless it's the OSI guys who have read the case file or Doty himself, have read the case file. So short of that, based on what I know, me personally, I would have been briefing up my chain appropriately everything I planned to do all the way. That's the way I did things.
Right.
That's how I stayed out of trouble. And, and many others, the overwhelming majority of agents.
And Doty did not do this?
I don't know. When I see what I know of it,
externally it looks like he might not have.
And if he didn't, you're right. Externally it looks like there's indicators that he might not have.
And also, Bill told me that he would try to execute plans on his own that were not thought up by his superiors.
Okay.
Basically, you told me early on that if you've got an operation and the people and you're an OSI agent, you've been doing it for a while, your superiors will go, do what you need to do. Do not break the law.
Well, no. Here's how it works. I mean, you as the agent, you quite often come up with most of your operations. You design them, you write them up, and you submit them. And then up the chain goes, you know, they approve it at the various levels. But you are designing your operation. Now, that said, okay, you're the one thinking up your tactics on the ground that have to fit within what, you know, regulation says you can and cannot do. And they do have to be approved. But just because you have that power and that authority to create your operations, you're still supposed to be briefing every step,
right.
And I do mean every step. You know, it's not that difficult. If you're going to be telling that person who's not in your organization something, it's the same as something we call passage material, which I will not go into.
Yeah, I know that.
You're damn right. Your boss and your region and your headquarters, they've all got to know it before you do it, and you've got to get the yes okay. Now, when you go out of that and do some things, you're walking on the thin ice, and you're getting yourself in trouble, and you're making everybody else look bad.
Ah.
you know, which is the least of it. Everyone else looking bad is the least of it. The worst of it is you're violating regulation.
And you might compromise the operation.
You might compromise a lot of things. And
just the operation.
But right. You may be inadvertently giving information that fills in a spot in something else that they want to know.
Yeah, exactly. You're giving people the piece of the puzzle. So my thing is, short of seeing the file, is I would have been, there would have been no doubt that I was briefing my superiors. You know, it would have been documented. Anybody associated with it would have known. Some of the peripheral people, like if I was in Doty's position, I was working with Bill, I would have commented to Bill and made statements to him that, okay, here's what I want to do, or I have some things in mind that I want to do. I am waiting for the approval on them because it must be approved. So I don't know how much of that kind of talk Bill heard, but that's what I would have done. I would have. The other thing is, with what I did, to wrap it up, with what I did, we were always taught asset safety is paramount. Now, with that ethic that you're working with, not just your asset, but particularly any citizens you're dealing with, unless they're a known criminal, you don't care, you know, so much as long as you're doing it right. But with somebody like in Benowitz's position.
He's not really an asset, though.
He's not an asset, but he's
still a person of interest.
But he is a person of interest because of a criminal activity, or just because he happened to be getting a little too close to something.
Well, it sounds like kind of a gray area with him.
Okay, but the thing is, he's a citizen.
Right.
He is a citizen. I know this sounds cheesy, but that's who we work for. And, you know, we're not supposed to be in the business of...
Doesn't sound cheesy to this audience.
...mentally fucking up the citizens. You know, that's just...
Right, right.
...the plain way to
I think that's probably outrage. I mean, it's just so outrageous. But, you know, that leads you... You know, that opens a doorway to, you know, running into paranoia. You know, a government paranoia. And, you know, and you just... Depending on how paranoid you're feeling on a given day. But the fact that, you know, it is quite legal, and I'm sure most of our audience knows this, but in case you don't, that the American public be used by their government. I mean, it's perfectly legal for them to, you know, say it goes so far back as the syphilis experiments done on blacks in the South at the mm-hmm. Tuskegee Institute, right, where they're knowingly not treated for a syphilis, so they could, you know, learn about the disease.
Or the flu virus sprayed out over San Francisco.
Yeah, all this. It's perfectly legal.
That.
I mean, your government has got the legal right to enroll you in an operation that you don't even know you're enrolled in, and use you as a guinea pig for information, experiment, or reactions, or for chemicals or biological warfare.
Still,
it's perfectly legal. Yeah.
Well, anybody who's been in the military, you're going to go through a deployment exercise, and just an exercise, and you don't have to be really deployed, but you go through a deployment exercise, and they go, hey, get your shot records out. And they decide, oh, you got to get your shot, you got to get your shot. Well, you're walking through a line getting a needle jabbed, and you're getting yellow fever or whatever, but you don't know exactly what's in that needle. You don't know what they're poking into your arm, but you signed up, you're in.
You're in,
and
they're on your ass.
One of the things you signed.
Yeah.
It's in the paperwork.
Oh, well, during the beginning of the Gulf War, there was a furore over a few soldiers who said, no, you're not inoculating me, they're not sticking a needle in me, and they got discharged, dishonorably discharged.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, the agreement is, when you sign into the military, is pretty much...
You're our meat.
You be on your ass.
Yeah.
You know, be on your ass. You know, and literally, you can meet. I remember back, this happened, a very minor punishment, but one of the guys in my outfit.
People do not know Richard was in the Army.
I was an artillery officer back during the Vietnam War. One guy in my outfit got a sunburn one day when we were out in the field, right? And he couldn't report for duty the next day. And, you know, the colonel gave him a special course martial for being sunburned, you know, because he couldn't report for duty.
Well, maybe he should have reported for duty, and then.
Well, he did, but I mean, he couldn't perform his job that day. He was so sunburned, he really hurt himself, and it was, you know,
it was
the color of his sun.
Did he get it on duty?
Yeah, he got it on duty. He was sitting up there. We were calling an artillery fire on targets, you know, up on the mountainside in Colorado Springs at Fort Carson, and he took off his shirt. It was early spring. He thought, I'll get a nice tan, you know, and so we sat up there for 3 or 4 hours.
It was his fault.
Absolutely his fault. You know, and they go, hey, you're damaging our equipment.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God.
I hate to say it, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does. You know, the agreement you make when you go into the military is pretty severe. I mean, you really are turning your life over to
you have fewer
people.
Rights. Much as a citizen,
rights,
you give up a lot of rights, and You got to be in fighting condition, and that's where all the they'd kind of like you to behave well.
Don't go out and come in hungover all the time.
Kind of condition.
I wanted to, as advertised, when I was talking about this show, you didn't read my write-up, but I mentioned the Navy guy. And I guess we can
Mike Younger, Com-12 debacle.
Okay. When I first met Richard, he said he was in contact with this guy from Naval Intelligence, and they were interested in getting the UFO information out to certain researchers. Richard became one of them. Melinda Leslie, I believe, became one of them.
Right. Steve Polidorus.
Steve, and by extension, myself. And I had a lot of conversations with Mike on the phone without you people around.
Right, and Robert Dean. Remember Robert O'Dean?
Was he connected with Dean, too?
Well, that's one of the things that struck me. I remember going to an Orange County UFO lecture, and Mike showed up, and Robert Dean was there. I don't know. I'd guess this would be around
95.
Just guessing. I'd say 95. Yeah, 95 most likely. 94, 95. And Dean went over and embraced Mike Younger with a big bear hug, right?
Right.
And who's the guy who's doing the research into implants? Not the doctor, but the guy who ex-CIA guy.
You mean the guy that says he's ex-CIA?
Yeah, that guy.
God, I think that guy's a doofus.
Yeah, exactly.
Daryl Sims.
Yeah, I went to hear Daryl Sims, and look at his little samples and things like that. That was the lecture at MUFON.
The alien hunter.
So anyway, the Dean comes up and sees Mike, goes over to him and embraces him. Robert Dean Mike and says, "You listen to this guy. This guy's the real thing." So he'd gotten Dean.
Dean said that to the
crowd.
Did Mike come up and talk to them?
No. He was in the back of the room. It was just people standing around waiting to talk to Dean or talk to Mike.
So for people who do not know, how did you meet this Mike guy? What did he tell you? Let's just go through a little bit of history of that, because I have some too.
That all happened when I was partnering with Don at UFO Magazine, and I was pretty much interning.
Weren't Don and Vicky basically scared senseless by him?
Don's big paranoia was, and rightfully
so. Not scared,
so,
but just like, I'm not getting near this guy because I'm going to be burned.
Yeah, exactly. Because they had experienced that before. Don had gotten burned in a previous experience with a guy, what's his name? I forget. A guy who claimed to have a background in the military and knew something about UFOs and was later exposed. And Don had gotten next to this guy and even helped him get a car or something. These guys are always colorful. Yeah. But later Don found out that nothing about it was true, and got burned. So he was trying to warn me about these kind of operators like Richard. And I remember him saying to me when I said, I'm gonna get a little bit close to this guy and check out what's going on, because if he is who he says he is, that's one thing. But I have a feeling it's more complicated than that, But whatever way the story goes, we got a story. I mean, if he is actually pumping disinformation and it's coming out of the government, then we got a story on, again, like Bill Moore, look what your government will do to you,
right?
And on the other hand, if this is the the opening volleys in an intelligence war that's going to be fought in the public over an issue which at the time seemed to be coming to some kind of crescendo, and having been new to the field, I just had to go, I had to play it forward. I had to pay it forward. I had to step into the arena. I had to get on the treadmill where it was and run with it. And there seemed to be a lot of shit happening then.
Well, the other thing is that Don and Vicky were in a different position because they were representing a media outlet.
Yeah, and I respected that.
And you were not, so it was a lot easier for you.
Yeah, and I also had the position my life, if there's something I want to do, I just go out and do it, That's how I, fought my way through Hollywood and had a career, and lots of things like that. You just go out and do it, my feeling is in the UFO field, it's like, get off your ass, get out in the field.
Right.
Don't sit back and wait for people to call you and sit back and just judge what they say. You can't do all your investigating by fucking telephone.
Yeah, well, you can, but don't come out and tell people your strongly held beliefs about so-and-so. And believe me because I know kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's like, take my word for it because I've gone and walked the walk and done the research and I've talked to these people, and if you want to ask them, they will say that they've talked to me, etc.
Well, the history on Younger is this. There were, I was
I'm sorry, interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's right. I was working with UFO Magazine with Donna Vicky. I was trying to develop projects, and I was kind of living there because it was my education. I was getting the, I mean, you know, where else are you going to get an education in the UFO subject? There's only one UFO magazine published in the United States, and that was UFO Magazine. And right. Fortunately, it was located right in Southern California in Sunland. So when I started getting into the subject, you know, picking up their magazine because it's what was available, I noticed that was published. And after several years, I decided I was going to approach them and see if I could, you know, after reading their magazine for several years, maybe we could work something out. As I tried to swim up from acting into producing, I was pretty tired of acting. I was getting a little long in the tooth to be standing in line going, "Can I have this job, please?" You know, could I support myself? Could you give me this guest star spot this week? You know, and then you get the part and you're so excited. Oh, God, I got the job. And you go do the work and you go, you know, well, gee, that was fast and it's over. And
what do I do next week?
Yeah, what do I do next week? Not only that, you go, but what did I just do? You know, basically I did nothing. I mean, it was like, not that I didn't do anything. I took a real crap and a role to play and all that kind of stuff. But basically the big picture is, it's just cotton candy. You know, it didn't have any meaning for me. You know, it's like I was really tired of it. I wanted something to sink my teeth into. I felt like life was passing me by. So I felt in the soap. So, you know, my approach to it was just like, okay, I got to jump in with both feet. And, you know, I'm going to get a little dirty. I'm going to make mistakes. And I'm going to keep moving, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what happened is that Steve Polidorus and who was the Undertaker? The Asian guy was the Undertaker?
Norio Hayakawa.
Norio Hayakawa. They were really steeped up in this whole conspiracy government stuff. Gary Schultz, you know.
I used to go to meetings at Schultz's house.
Yeah, that whole period. I mean, it's like, you know, there's certain things that come and go like storms, you know. And that was a period where this storm was passing through the UFO crowd. We don't know about that. And it was all very complicated, you know, because you had... you know, people having amazing, interesting, indescribable sightings, standing on the side of the road, looking into by the mailbox and seeing lights rise up and glow real bright.
Area 51, if people
shoot left and shoot right, and people going, "Well, there's got to be those captured alien UFOs," you know. And yeah, I'm sure that's just what they were. Little grays were running around. They run beneath your feet, man. Standing at the mailbox. Just be careful, you know. A gray might sneak up and bite you on the ass without you even knowing. You know, there was all this sort of momentum and hysteria and paranoia, and Gary Schultz was sponsoring these conspiracy seminars, you know. And
at his house.
Norio Hayakawa, they were all wrapped up in this, and Steve Polidorus. And they were sponsoring the greatest conspiracy seminar ever. And they'd called UFO Magazine several times to ask Vicky to cover it.
Yeah, I remember this.
You know,
was it West LA somewhere?
It was in Santa Monica at the Women's Club on 4th Street, you know, which is about 6 blocks from where I live. And I just spent the day with Donna Vicky, and I just gotten home. It was about 6 o'clock, and she called me and said, "I just got a call again from, you know, those guys, and they want somebody to cover this speech tonight." And she said, "I don't really feel like driving over there. It could be interesting. I mean, this COM-12 stuff is starting to come up, and people are talking about COM-12. Would you want to go over there and cover it for us?"
Supposedly a Navy thing.
Yeah, supposedly a Navy thing. And I'm going, "What is it? You know, huh? What?" "Well, just go over there and cover it, you know. If you do, would you do that for us?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll do that. It's just about a half mile from my house." So I went, and, you know, as a representing UFO Magazine. And so I, you know, I got there just as it was starting. And so intermission, I went up and said, "Look, I'm here covering for UFO Magazine, you know, for Donna Vicky. I just had, you know, usually you have to let people know if you're representing press." So I did that. But that was at the intermission, and the first hour was quite fascinating, you know. I felt like, you know, I couldn't take these people seriously at first at all. You know, it was like you go, "What the?" You know, "Holy Jesus, man, there's some weird little subcultures around." But he was sharing a lot of information about a lot of things. UFO was just one of them, you know. It was more like the government and conspiracy and FEMA and, you know, I don't know. I got notes. I still got the notes from back then. But some of the things he was saying were obviously true and quite interesting, and other things we didn't know if they were true, but it was fairly interesting. So at intermission, I introduced myself, and he said, "Well, I don't have time right now, but see me afterwards." So afterwards, he passed me a little card with a number written on it. He says, you know, gave me instructions on, you know, you get an answering machine, and when the outgoing message is over and it beeps, then say something and leave a number and hang up, and somebody will get back to you, you know. So, you know, that's how it started. You know, so they kind of got me in this, okay, we're going into the deep, dark, undercover world now, you know. And I go, here we go, you know. And so I'm telling Don and Vicky, I said, well, I covered it, and it's kind of a mixed bag, you know. I think they're full of shit, but on the other hand, it's kind of interesting, you know. I was kind of, and I want to go a little further and see what the fuck this is all about, pardon my French, you know.
Alice
and Vicky was kind of like, you know, yeah, just be careful. But Don's more like, Richard, I'm telling you, you're going to get burned, you know. And, you know, in his own inimitable, very, you know, forceful way. And I said, Don, I understand that I may get burned, you know. And the thing is, you know, I don't know how else to get into this except to get into it. I mean, you don't get information from people who are holding you away. You've got to go in and become part of that thing. You've got to fall in love with them. They got to fall in love with you. They got to take you in. You got to become, you know.
You've got to develop a relationship with people,
right,
to, you know. Otherwise, I just think you're some jerk off, and they're not going to talk to
right.
you.
And you got to do favors
show you're
for
serious.
Them. You got to show them that you're serious. And sometimes you're going to do things that you wouldn't normally do. Maybe tell a few little white lies. Maybe push a little bit. But that's like that's part of your cover. You got to, you know. I had to be willing to take on a cover, so that any time I was out there, I was on the phone or anything else, it's like nobody was going to hear anything different than I was buying into all this stuff. Otherwise, for me to get anything out of it, I had to convince everybody that I was totally bought into it, you know.
Sure.
And within that, sometimes I bought into it, and then sometimes I bought out of it, you know. And we'd have these long conversations. I remember, you know, Polydorus saying, Steve, this is so wrong. And even Polydorus and those guys, yeah, something's not right here, you know. But his information and his ability to do research and his data was just superb. Many of the things became like really significant source of information, documents and things like this, all came out of his little project called COM-12. You know, I mean, the greatest CIA task force document. There was, what else?
There was a bunch of, he had a lot of MKUltra, Artichoke, Naomi stuff.
He had all that stuff. And
stuff that I don't think has been published.
No. And on top of that, he had those, the magazines that are in-house magazines published within the military-industrial complex by different providers, right? That goes out and is classified as it goes out to the people within that community, right? The engineers working in this community, that community, like this. And he had a whole series, and boy, I'd like to have gotten my hands on those. Addition to these magazines, he would show, and you go through them, and you see ads for things inside. It would just blow your mind. You know, what they were, technologies they were offering, and we have developed this and this and this, which is available. I'm sure you've seen organs like this, Walter. Maybe, perhaps you have inside the military?
What comes to mind is something I saw at Nellis, I think, once in a lobby, in an interior, internal.
Right, inside.
You
know, yeah. Yeah, you know what I mean? You see those things, you go, whoa, how interesting.
Well, case in point, one of them was the first time, I like to say it was the first flying saucer I ever saw, and it was the first time I ever saw the flying saucers they use, their drones.
Right.
They're not manned, at Ground Zero, at the nuclear test site, where they go in where it's radiated and they can land them and pick them up.
Oh, at Southern Nevada, what's the place called?
Frenchman's Flat?
I spent 30 days working there when I was with FBI.
You mean Frenchman Flats, where we did the test?
No,
or?
Damn. Now I'm doing a complete brain dump.
Nevada
Test
like Site.
Idiot. Yeah, NTS, Nevada Test Site. Yeah. But there's another colloquial name for it. But I had never seen that in public, and it was a couple of years before I ever saw that in a public forum, and I believe it was in a UFO-related magazine. Ooh, what's this?
Yeah, right.
And I remember going,
exactly, right, yeah.
So, yeah.
Right, you know. Take the close-up, and it says, you know, made in USA.
Mercury.
That's right.
Mercury test site.
Yeah.
But anyway, what was the trigger question on this?
The trigger question was, how did you meet Mike? What developed?
Right.
And just the story, because the end of it didn't come till a couple of years after he died, and we could get to that too without going into too much detail, because we're thinking of maybe writing something up about it eventually.
Yeah, well, all I can say is that
plus some of it's kind of personal about Mike.
Very, but what happened is that you know, he was a very unique fellow, and he was a brilliant mind. That without question, the man had an incredible mind, encyclopedic knowledge. Yeah, sometimes you'd ask him a question about something, and he could talk for the next hour and a half almost as if he was reading it off a script. It used to be spooky. I mean, sentence structure, everything else, you go like, how the fuck does this guy do this?
Yeah.
You know, it'd be...
He was a sharp dude.
Really sharp dude, and very artistic dude, too. Yeah. And I suspect psychically very gifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, may have even developed his own sort of remote viewing techniques. That's what I think. I have a little bit of experience with him doing that with a high degree of success, you know, having been part of it, watching him do that. And I never knew if he was trained by the military or if it's just something he was naturally able to do.
Mm. Another question for you.
Quite, you know, it was some pretty interesting soup that spun around him, you know. And
yeah,
to this day, I don't know I don't think we know the whole truth of Mike Younger, although we know he's not who he said he was.
Right.
But I don't think, like I told him, I tried to tell Don, but Don's not one for Shades of Grey or for, you know, tolerating the fact that I told you he was a piece of shit, and you bought into it, so, you know, you fool you.
He throws the baby out
of
the
bathroom. And on the other hand, you know, when I got good information, he was only too happy to listen to it, mm-hmm. both he and Vicky, you know.
Yeah, when you go out and do the work for people,
right.
they would like to hear the meat of it.
I got such an education, you know. I mean, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's what you ultimately came away with, and
right.
I came away with, and everybody else did, was an education on a lot of things connected to the UFO subject that you wouldn't think necessarily were.
Right.
The political ramifications of such things.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about it.
And
for me, so broad, you know?
Yeah. And for me, having the crap scared out of me so that I could realize that there was nothing really to be scared of in a certain way.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I
don't know if he was specifically doing that to do that to me or what.
Well, I don't know either, but I think he was a little paranoid,
you know,
because, you know...
People can watch you, and there's people outside of your house, and people can read off your computer screen, you know,
right.
from across the street, and, you know, all these things. And I started getting weird phone calls, hang-up phone calls.
Right, right. But that's, I mean, there's so
much
swirling around.
It was a conscious decision, but that was something I took away from Mike. What,
right.
One important thing is don't worry so much about it.
Yeah, and the thing is, there was a lot of stuff swirling around Mike. I mean, I'm sure, you know, there was.
Yeah, not to say he was a total fake. He wasn't.
No, it's a complicated picture, and it's hard to, you know, maybe, like I say, maybe we'll do that book sometime.
The typical American audience, I can't speak for the rest of the world, is they want things to be convenient. They want it to be easy. They want you to do your thinking for them, because for the last several decades, America has been the trust the specialist society.
Right.
That's why we kiss ass to people with pedigrees. Oh, he's got this pedigree, so what he says about this phenomenon is true. And the guy who doesn't have the, you know, pedigree, he's full of shit because he's not a specialist.
Breaking off from Britain my ass. Yeah.
You know, it's bullshit, and I've said it here before, Americans who do that are ignorant. We need to get off the specialist obsession.
I was lucky. I had a family life and an education where they would say, wait, take a look at this. What do you think?
Yeah.
Not, here's a bunch of stuff, now repeat it back to me. It's, here's a bunch of stuff, now you tell me what your interpretation is. Do you think it's right? Think about it for a minute. And I would have my father argue an opposite side of an argument with me, even if he didn't agree with it, just to see how I would react. And he did this to me constantly, and he still does.
Devil's advocate.
Yeah, a devil's advocate thing, and I do that constantly now, too. And that's why when something like this happens with Mike, I didn't realize it at the time, but... You know, it was exciting. Oh, somebody who knows something and who might be from the government is paying attention to me.
Right.
And a lot of people make mistake. Oh, he's paying attention to me. It must mean I'm special, and he's giving me good information, so I'm going to spit it right back out and tell everybody about it.
Yeah.
And if you're that type, that's the kind of person you're going to attract, and that's the kind of information you're going to get, which is generally crap.
Right.
But if you shut up about it, you don't say anything, and you're quiet, you'll still get a lot of crap, but once in a while you get a nugget.
Exactly.
And this is what I found with Mike.
Right, exactly right.
Well,
and that's what, you know, like when, several times, actually.
I was saying this was my education, and Richard was right there, and he was helping me, and this is what I'm having him describe.
Yeah, and the thing is, several times we did guest on Don Ecker's show, you know, and Mike shared information, and I said, you know, have him on, you know, it'd be interesting. And he did. We shared those documents with Stormont Labs solving the Inogen problem and, you know, their own that was very sensitive data that he'd gotten a hold of, because on the heels of that, of those revelations and the outing of those Stormont documents, Stormont changed the name of its lab.
What was the Stormont lab document stuff?
Well, it was just a kind of it looked like an in-house briefing on state of certain things they were doing.
Like?
Well, they're talking about having solved the antigen problem. In other words, you could not worry about what kind of blood you're pumping into a soldier on a battlefield. You know, they could make any blood acceptable.
That's cool.
Yeah, they could
even
organ
maybe
transplant.
Cattle blood?
Well, yeah, now we're getting to another whole area, right? But, you know, it brags on the fact that the last line, it says, the essence of, not this, the wrong words, but like the very basic processes of life lie bare and open to us now.
No, that was the article from the Military Review called Ethnic Weapons by Carl, I can't remember his last name. After he described how ethnic weapons work, he said the processes of life now lie open to attack.
That's true, but this is different. This was a similar but different quote.
Oh, okay.
You know, in the Stormont document. They talk about, you know, having...
Oh, they probably have read that article.
Yeah.
Carl Larson. It was Larson. The guy's name was Larson.
Yeah, I remember Carl Larson. But in this document, they also made a Stormont document that they had the cures for hepatitis A, B, and C. C had a cure for. It's looked upon as a weapon.
The
cure for disease is a weapon. Why? By withholding the cure, you can let people die of hepatitis C. You know, you could, and these are kind of part of ethnic weaponry, right? Well, anyway, with the outing of that document, man, there was a lot of heat came our way. You know, it was very interesting. Very interesting. We, you know, that's the time we picked up a tail. And, you know, and we came out of that UFO, guesting on UFOs Tonight, his cable radio show, and out in the parking lot. You know, there was a hired private security person sitting out in the parking lot that we copied on his license plate. He had like 9 aerials in his car, and he was in there with a little light taking notes of who was waiting to go inside and do UFO magazine and taking pictures. And he was sitting in a tinted window old station wagon with about 9 aerials sticking on the top of it. And when Mike arrived with a few of his friends to be the guest on the show, they had scouted, noticed this guy sitting in the parking lot. And so we went over there and literally walked up to the car and looked in the window. And there was this guy, and he had a yellow pad, and he was writing things on a yellow pad, and he had a camera next to him, and he had this CB radio. And the CB radio call sound was in the back of the station wagon. So a couple of Mike's friends were up on the hill across the street, supposedly part of his team, had used this call sign and called him. And he actually, you know, was writing, and all of a sudden his head came up like, huh, what's that? And then he looked up and he realized we were both standing, one on each side of the car, looking in at him, and he just freaked, you know, and he started the car and left. So we ran his license plate and his CB code number and found out his name and found out he was a private investigator with an expired license, but he was working for Lockheed Sanders. You know, that he'd been hired by Lockheed Sanders to come do this. And you go, now why would Lockheed Sanders care about UFO magazine, have a guy sitting in a parking lot at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night taking pictures and writing stuff down? It gets like,
What are they working on?
What are we doing that interests? Which, huh? What? You know?
Yeah.
I had my wife followed by a guy from L.A. Air Force Base for an entire day once.
Yeah.
I wasn't with her, but it was obvious he was from the Air Force Base, and he made it obvious to her that he was following her.
Yeah, and that probably goes back to Mike somehow.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, at the time, I think, because what we were doing, what was going on at that time.
Well.
You know? And many a time, I'd arranged to meet Mike in Orange County, and I was followed by a tan van, like a Ford van. No matter where I went, this tan van would be there, you know, pick me up on the road, like it picked up our meeting, you know. I would drive, I'd see this van, I'd park. I'd go in and maybe meet with Mike for 2 or 3 hours, I'd come out, there'd be the van. I'd leave, the van would leave with me.
We've got
tan, huh?
Now, another interesting thing I thought was, tan. Now, another thing I thought was interesting is that one night we came out of a restaurant we've been talking, and this tan van kind of cruised past it. We're standing behind Mike's pickup truck talking for about an hour outside. And finding this van, which we've been watching, parked down in the parking lot further from the restaurant, backs out and then cruises very slowly past us and takes pictures. Right? The guy leans over and goes, snap, snap. And I looked at Mike and I said, what the fuck is that? He said, he comes around again, just you walk up and talk to him. I said, do you have any idea who that is? He says, yeah, I think I know who that is. I said, who? And he said, David Morehouse.
What?
The RV guy.
This was about 2 years before David Morehouse was ever heard of
I remember this David Morehouse watch out for him thing.
Right. That's what made me, suddenly I made a connection between remote viewing.
Was it Morehouse?
Huh.
Or did you take Mike's word for it?
Here's the thing. First of all, there was no David Morehouse. His name, it could have just been Joe Smith.
Right.
David Morehouse had not written a book that had been published. There was no David Morehouse written in any remote viewing books. David Morehouse was not a public UFO figure or remote viewing figure. That had not come out yet.
Right.
But somehow he
dropped that name
and was not frightened by David Morehouse. Was kind of
interested.
Well, not just interested, it's sort of
how does this
there was a history going on. There was a history between them.
Okay.
See, there was a sense of a history between them.
Was it almost, he was amused by it?
No, he's like, yeah, that motherfucker David Morehouse.
Ah, okay.
You know, they'd had some run-ins before. Mm. And now, it depends how far you want to go. My suspicion is that, this had to do with remote viewing. You know, and Mike, I think, had a natural, or who knows, maybe, I don't know how, a training in remote viewing, because the guy could do things that I can't describe. He could do things that sometimes were just spooky, you know.
Yeah, but the mistake that somebody would have made was to believe everything he was saying.
You don't.
Because he said a lot of stuff that
right.
there was no way to check out.
No.
He used to bring suitcase, his briefcase, full and say, look at this picture. And it's like, that looks like a Photoshop picture of something flying over what he says is Area 51. I'm not going to say that to him. I'll just look at it and say, oh, that's interesting.
Well, to me, it's like, that's what I expect if somebody's an agent. I expect them to try to feed me bullshit.
Right.
You know, so I go, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Oh, yeah. I think that's a piece of shit. He'd get into that and go, yeah, well, you're right. You know? Or if I said,
that's funny. I never called him on it. I just kind of nodded and smiled a lot.
Yeah, well, you got to do that. I mean, it's like, you know, you do like, but it's not like I'm going, oh, I buy everything. I go, this guy's, this is clumsy. This is really clumsy. He's suddenly being really, really clumsy.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, and this is some kind of, what kind of...
And after a while, you realize it's on purpose.
Yeah.
How do you react to that clumsiness?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got probably 5 minutes left.
Take it where you want to go.
Well, where I wanted to go was, what happened with Mike later? How did you kind of stop communicating with him? And,
well, at one point, Mike tried to get...
What was the last news you heard about him?
All right. I mean, at one point... It was after we had done Steve Polidoros had produced a radio show called The Blue File, and asked me to host it, right. And Robert Dean was our guest, right? And he actually came to Steve's house. That's where we recorded it, at Steve's house. And we did a phone hookup with Robert Dean from Steve's house, right? And Mike came over. Now, Mike had disappeared for a while and was trying to, but Steve Polidoros had his home phone number and knew his wife and the kids, right? So he kept hounding Mike. Mike said, no, I'm done. I'm out. Leave me alone. No, I'm going away. Leave me alone. I'm done with this, right? But Paul was kind of hounding him. So he showed up there that night, and he was kind of agitated. And we did the show with Dean. And then some of the people would come to be there while the show left. It was just like Steve and I and Mike. And Mike, I think, was making an attempt to come clean. He takes out his wallet and says, look, I've always told you that I'm not Mike Younger. That's the we took that name because that's the outlaw gang. You know, my whole family has that name, and it was true. His family had a phony name, and there's all kind of curious things. He had been raised by a woman who wasn't really his mother. His mother and father, I guess his father had been a cop of the LAPD, but the woman who really raised him was around, and when we started checking back on Mike's background, there was all through the late 80s, this was going on. Mike would say, I'm out of town. Well, it turns out he wasn't out of town. His wife would say, no, he was here. But she would say, there was another phone that he had, a satellite phone. And that was, off limits to everybody. But when that phone rang, he'd answer that phone, and that was it. He'd go off and talk to that person no matter what. So somewhere, somehow, there was some relationship where something was going on that even his family was excluded from.
He was on somebody's leash.
Exactly. He was on somebody's leash. And I suspect that long on. And the only way I could feel like it closer is I had to convince the world that I was totally bought in, hoping that that would lead me a little closer. They would draw me closer. And what I was always going for, and I think I told Greg this, and I think I even told Don this, I want to meet the person that's running this person.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to, angle
sure,
towards.
Yeah.
And so whatever I did was to try to, maybe set that situation up where that would happen. Of course, it never happened, but I do think there was that person. I still think there was
that
person.
It sounds like that the guy wasn't a fake. He just, as Greg said earlier, was just not what he had said he was.
Yes, and he was being used.
Yes.
Well, and he knew he was being used, and he was probably trying to do the same thing at a different level that we were.
Yes.
And there were some interpersonal relationships with the people that he was dealing with, which made it more complicated.
And there were some pretty prominent people, including a couple of scientists, one of which I got to meet with Mike one time, and this guy's very old. This guy's probably in his 80s now and lives in Eagle Rock. And this guy was, you know, Lawrence Livermore, big deal retired scientist, you know, his name was in Who's Who. I can look it up right now. I don't remember. That's 15 years ago. But this guy had a lot of respect and admiration for Mike, and I remember meeting him, and this guy was totally checkoutable. When I checked him out, he was exactly who he said he was. So mm-hmm. I go, this guy, you know, Mike's got some interesting relationships. Mike had provided some kind of security for him at some point.
Yeah. That's, you know, how what? A lot of these people, they don't care who you are. They will check you out.
Yeah.
But if you bring them information, one, that you're not supposed to know, and they know is true, and or information that they're looking for and puts in a piece of the puzzle, then you're in with them,
right,
at least for a while
right,
you're useful.
Right.
And while you're useful, you make use of that time.
Right. That's it, Greg. You know the game. But unless you play the game, you don't know the game.
Right. And it's 10 o'clock.
Ah. Well, we'll continue this. There's a whole lot more to say.
Yes, there's a ton more to say. Yeah. And I guess that means you're agreeing to come back at some point in
sure,
the future.
Sure, you know.
Okay.
I took the day off tomorrow, so I feel really free.
Okay. The one last thing. I think I told you this, too. Mike called me up once after we'd been talking for quite a while. And he asked me to go down to Tijuana and buy him drugs.
What kind? Do you not remember?
GHB.
GHB.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's scary.
Yeah. And I said, no, I don't think I'm going to do that.
Well, you know, towards the end there, he was really, really, really getting wacky.
Mm-hmm.
Really weird.
Yeah, it was during that period.
Yeah.
So that's a cliffhanger for when Richard will come back. And I'm sure, we've had more listeners on this show than we've had in weeks. And that shows that what we're talking about is good stuff and things that people want to know about. And that Richard is a great guest.
And you got me to shut up. That's what did it.
You just couldn't talk over me.
So we'll see what reactions we get. And we'll have Richard on again soon. So it's been Radio Misterioso. Our guest has been Richard Saraday, my buddy and unknown UFO researcher that more people should know about. So thank you, Richard.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to coming back.
All right. And we look forward to having you back. And Walter, who I'm glad is here to hear this because he has perspective that I don't. And when Richard comes back, Walter will be here too, I'm certain. It's been Radio Misterioso. See you next week. Thanks for listening. And here's an old favorite.
It was the night of the dance in the high school gym, when all at once something flashed and the lights grew dim. Then with a zoom and a zip in the room flew a ship, manned by men who were 2 feet ten, all singing,
"Take me to your ear, cha-cha-cha, take me to your ear, cha-cha-cha."
Each man was made of Band-Aid and a bobby pin, electric bulbs blinking.